Well, thank you so much, Ash. It's a pleasure to get a chance to chat with you. I'm absolutely blown away continually, episode by episode here in the third season, and as much crumbs and screen time as we're getting for M, I'm just like, where can we get more? Like, what's going to happen next?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk with you today. I'm glad we can finally make this happen.
Yes, thank you. We sort of left M ambiguously in season two, after the big like Camarilla infiltration, and didn't really know what would happen with M come season three. And I wanted to kind of ask, how far in advance did you know that M would be returning, and the kind of scope of position we would see for M this season?
I think it was August of last year that the formal announcement came out about Motherland Fort Salem being renewed for a quote third and final season, end quote. I honestly had no idea though how much or even if M would be showing up within the continuation of the narratives that kind of left off at the end of season two. If I'm recalling correctly, I don't think I found out if I was going to be returning for like as M or for how many episodes until quite close to the beginning of principal photography for season three, which was sometime in September of last year. And I don't think that's too uncommon in TV world. There's so much stuff going on behind the scenes when it comes to the writers and any other creatives involved in dreaming up the ways that a new season might take shape. So it all has to get written, and there's outlines, and it has to be run by a network, and then it goes back to the drawing board for edits and rewrites. And there's just so many steps that actors aren't privy to in the process of creating the shows that we love to watch. And consequently, it's often the case in our industry, you kind of find out about stuff without a ton of notice. I was, however, very excited when I did finally receive confirmation that M was going to be in season three. And in the capacity that we're starting to see unfold now that we're at episode four, I believe, has aired at the time of this recording.
Yes, we just finished episode four, and then this coming week on Tuesday will be episode five, where it's kind of like mid-season bittersweetness. I'm like,
I
not ready,
know.
but we all want to know what's going to happen at the same time.
Yes, for sure.
Well, in episode one, we actually get the return of M, with this really emotionally vulnerable scene, with M and Anacostia, where M talks about kind of not having a direction and feeling a little bit lost. And Anacostia obviously gets M on this infiltrating, secret infiltration, James Bond M type Camarilla, infiltration meeting. And then ultimately, of course, as the next episodes kind of air, onto Wade's detail. And then, like in episode four, which we just were talking about, talks a little bit about also how Alder really pushed them to go to War College. So I wanted to ask, what do you kind of think these two dynamics and influences between our Mama Costia and Alder, what these two influences really signify with these two different but also really important pivotal moments, as well as figures for M, who are really, I guess, shaping their career and shaping the person that they are at the same time.
I felt that Anacostia was a strong role model for M within the military system that we see in the world of Motherland. For M, Anacostia would be one of those people in your life that you just want to bring your absolute best for, no matter what the situation is. Someone that you look up to in terms of leadership and competence and skill, and who really brings out the best in you, but also expects nothing less than that. So in season two, much of what we got from M was a peek at maybe a sense of wry humor and a bit of a cavalier approach to the strong personalities within the bellwether unit. Like, we saw that for all of M's quippiness, they're all business when the pressure is on. They'll kick Camarilla ass if they have to, but they're always in leader mode, even when there's members of the bellwether unit that are testing their boundaries within the social dynamics of the coven. But in season three, in this moment with Anacostia in her office, it's really the first time that we've been allowed to see M as somebody who exists outside of leadership mode. And in this moment, I think we're really seeing them as someone who has grave doubts about the decisions that they've had to make as a leader, as someone who is wrestling with guilt at having failed at what they were tasked with. It's a moment that we get to see M as a full person, just for a moment, who's flawed and has made mistakes and wants desperately to do better if given the chance. Having this moment with Anacostia, in front of Anacostia, who was like the blueprint for excellence and competence here, was, I think, a very humbling and raw moment of vulnerability that I think gave us a sense of the scope of how the events of season two are like weighing on all the characters we love in this show as we walked into season three, you know? To the second episode you referenced for episode four, I'm not sure that Em's relationship with Alder is even remotely comparable to the one they have with Anacostia. Like, Anacostia is this human figure, whereas for Em, I think it, in order to think about what their relationship is to Alder, we would have to consider Em's perspective as a non-binary witch coming into the military. And I know we're going to talk about this more in a moment, but Em would have, like, Em did have to pick. And Alder is in the business of running a military, not holding hands for people who don't fit into a very rigid option A or option B system. Em would have grown up knowing this and kind of marching on with some kind of resignation towards their fate with every birthday that passed. And I think that if Alder extended War College as an option to Em, it was, from Alder's perspective, it would have purely just been like, I see talent in you. I think you should be in a leadership role. For Em, it would have been a moment to seize, to perhaps get out of some of the most rigidly gendered aspects of the world of Motherland. When we hear that discussion of women going into basic training and men going into weapons building, of course we see the gender binary echoed in many other aspects of life and work in Motherland, but that is like one of the most concrete examples. And War College represented an opportunity that wasn't structured with gender, it was structured by units and covens. And if Alder recognized that skill in leadership in M back in their early soldier days, and I'd say that Anacostia must have seen how that training and continuing military service polished whatever raw material M had into something potent and dangerous and useful, and was able to give it direction.
Yes, and Anacostia, as we know, also has this kind of great nurturing to her as well. So it feels kind of befitting also in a sense too, because Anacostia, when we leave Alder, calls her mother, and then Anacostia, we call her Mama Costia.
Yes.
So it's a sort of a continued motherly-esque type of position in a sense as well, in my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely see that that nurturing side that Anacostia can bring out, but also, like you're talking about, you know, making sure things are polished and making sure someone has the best that's brought out in them at the same time.
Yeah, if I had to contrast what the relationship between Anacostia and Em would be to the relationship between Em and Alder, I mean, Alder kind of, yes, it was an opportunity to go to War College or a suggestion from somebody in a position of supreme authority to direct your life in that kind of way. But the Alder bit kind of feels like, go for it, kid, throwing you into the fire. Whereas the Anacostia one is like, no, I see you, and I really think that this is the direction you should go in. One feels human and close, and the other feels distant and removed, although both played very pivotal roles in how M's life has gone.
Well, we talk about this meaningful conversation that Tally and Em shared at Yule, and we talk about Em's backstory, and wanted to ask, how did the writers really approach you at all when it came to the dialogue and the essential components of bringing about this beautiful, meaningful backstory that really brings another layer to your character. I know you made a post, of course, about it through IG. And that was a beautiful and meaningful post just as well to learn a little bit more about that aspect as well.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, Instagram limits me to 2,200 characters, and now you're at my mercy on an audio call. So, no, I'm kidding. Yeah, yes, I was brought into that conversation. One of the questions I saw the most from fans of the show when it came to the character of M is, how did someone like M end up where they are? And I'm very happy that the creators and writers prioritized spending some time on this subject for M this season. And there's so much going on. Like, it would have been so easy to be like, we don't have time for this. The world is ending. All of our heroes are fractured and scattered across the continent. Like, there's no time. But they made the time. And I think that's important. This scene was in development for a while, especially in the grand scheme of how things often happen for TV timelines. I was very privileged to be brought into the workshopping of this scene by our episode 4 writer, Nicole Lavinia, as well as the other creatives behind The Magic of Motherland. And it was not easy. It was quite a daunting task because M is a non-binary witch in a world which we've seen as heavily structured and governed by codes and standards that adhere to a rigid gender binary. And if you spend just a few brief moments, like, really thinking about how transgender and non-binary witches might exist within the world of Motherland, we don't get to explore that. We don't see it. It's not addressed. But if we just pause and actually think about how that might play out, I think it becomes apparent quite quickly that it would not perhaps enjoy the same semi-utopian, it's not a big deal, non-event quality that queer and non-heterosexual relationships enjoy on the show. It's just not possible. If people are forced into rigid, militarized societal roles based on gender, or perhaps not even on gender, but biological sex, like, how do those metals know which one you are? It's a subject that really sits at odds with where current conversations and activism is within trans and non-binary communities, and that only added to the challenge of writing this scene. It's also, you know, not in any way the focus of the show, so another challenging aspect of tackling the scene was trying to nod towards what M's experiences might have been like without completely opening a can of worms that there would never be time to unpack, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make M three-dimensional for my work as an actor who is non-binary and trans, I wrote 10 pages of headcanon for myself for how trans and non-binary witches might, like, make sense or exist in the world of Motherland. And I developed that over many, many very generous, lengthy conversations with Arlen Aguayo-Stewart, who, of course, we know and love as Nicta.
Yes.
I shared what I thought and talked about with Arlen, with Nicole, the writer, and the other creatives, and we worked and reworked and reworked that scene to try to do the subject justice. We were making those tweaks and edits right up until the literal moment that we were called to set to shoot. And honestly, when it came time to shoot that scene, I think that's one of the moments in my experiences shooting 2 seasons of Motherland that I felt the most grounded and present. And there's parts of that conversation between Jess and myself, between Tally and M, that I think just kind of slid out naturally and that people went with. It was a team effort to make that scene as grounded and meaningful as it was. And I know the response from fans in the wake of episode 4 airing has been resoundingly positive, which makes me really happy and more than a little relieved that we didn't completely screw it up.
Just getting to see that reflected on screen is huge. I mean, this world of Motherland, like we talk about, is so inclusive, and to continuing to watch it expand, grow, and educate, it's really important. I know I'm still learning. I hope everyone else who watches is still learning. And I think that Motherland sets a really good bar, a really nice high bar when it comes to including these types of things and including the cast and important conversations like that.
I think that's probably a moment that any actor in a similar position would be grateful for, because the alternative is having to say words that maybe don't accurately reflect yours and other people like you's lived realities. That was not the way to conjugate what I was trying to say, but you know what I meant.
Yes, yeah. The umbrella continues to be so large, and rightfully so. As in a sense of like the umbrella for terms and things like that to continue to grow. I think that's important to recognize and continue to show as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I get messages sometimes from people who tell me that seeing the character of M on their screens was a tipping point for like their mom or dad to be able to have that conversation with them about their identity that falls somewhere under the non-binary umbrella, or that it felt like for the first time something that they hadn't been able to put into words was being reflected back at them. People of all ages, like young and old, it's certainly provided fertile ground for conversations that I think have had meaningful impacts on people's lives, which is it's a beautiful thing.
Well, it is so rewarding for M to tell Telly about their experience, and really, as we talk about this important kind of signifier for representation, along with M talking to Telly by saying they see her. Telly's a nurturer character, a lot like Anacostia, and a compassionate person. We obviously know her power is sight. But she's often kind of like the third wheel or like an outsider in the sense of, especially
Yeah.
this season of couples.
Poor Tally. Way to make a girl feel single.
Exactly. Exactly. And it feels kind of befitting for M to really kind of impart this comment to Sally that they see her. And how does this moment of bonding and kind of validation between them stand as sort of a little bit of a turning point for each of them in a way?
Interesting. Yeah. I think we haven't really gotten to see any moments of one-on-one interaction between Tally and M since that sparring session in season two, which everyone was very thirsty about, but clearly had an educational dynamic to it. But I think we also get to really feel a deep her sense in this of how Tally's feeling like the odd one out in the context of her unit mate, right? Like Rael and Scylla have each other. There's Abigail and Adil. There's Adil and Kalita. Tally had that deep connection with Alder in season two, with the whole process of being biddied and then unbiddied. But then, Alder got swallowed up by the mycelium and has returned, but Tally remains a bit of an island. Jumping back to M for a moment, M's been guided into Wade's Secret Service thanks to Anacostia's strategizing. And I think that because M is finally outside of the formal structure of the military, they're not a coven leader in their role this season, right? Like they're working for the president, they're working for Wade, even if they were placed there by Spymaster Anacostia. And because there's that separation, that technical separation, I think it made an opportunity for M to let their guard down a bit and connect on a more human level with someone like Tally, who was formerly under their charge. Like it kind of gives me that vibe of like when you grow up and you like run into your favorite English teacher at the grocery store and you're like, oh, you're a human being with a first name. Right. We can talk about things other than grammar. That's a really terrible example. But basically, M and Tally are shifting into new roles, each of them. They're going into unknown territory. And their paths might be diverging, but the similarities between what they're both wrestling currently or have wrestled with stand. And there's many times in our lives, if we just want to extrapolate from the show here, go big picture. I think most of us can relate that there's times in our lives where we feel like we're going it alone, even when we're surrounded by our loved ones. And these are sometimes like the most isolating experiences. It's one thing to feel deeply alone and feel like we don't have a support network or people who really understand us or people who have time to listen to us. But when you feel alone, when you're surrounded by other people, it's a really tough feeling. And I think that in those moments, sometimes it's an encouraging word or a gesture of support from someone that isn't in our innermost circle that can be really meaningful. Like there's a sweetness to the bitter moments of life when we can translate our own hard experiences into a moment of connection or validation for someone else. I think that's what's happening with Em and Tally. I think that's what we got to see in that scene, you know?
Yeah, and we see in the beginning of the season that, and I guess a little bit towards in season two, Nikta being like an influence and a mentor and a trainer, in a sense, for Tally. And then Nikta's off went off with Scylla, and then Nikta, you know, is sort of more spending more time with Scylla, so we're seeing, than with Tally, and doing certain things because they're all captured. They can't, yes. You know, they can't go off and like, you know, train each other while they're under in the session like that. So
right.
Tally has this new power. She doesn't know how to use it just yet as so well. She hasn't really had the time or been able to practice. She doesn't have Nikta being her mentor in the moment, sort of. And the single Pringle again.
Single Pringle.
So it's nice to have someone who cares, nice to have someone who can sit down and talk to her and kind of just like check in and give her some support that she may need.
Yeah, it's like in those moments, like sometimes what you want, like what your heart really wants is like for someone to take that situation away or take that pain or difficult feeling away. Like you just don't want to be alone. But like, I think one of the cold realities of adulthood is that it's just not possible sometimes. You just have to keep slogging sometimes, even when that's the last thing that you want to do. And so if you're in that situation, then what's the next best thing? Somebody being like, no, you can do it. I'm really sorry I can't walk on this path with you, but I know you can do it, and you've got it. You got this. You can do it.
We get to see you working more with Dimitri as we talk about Mama Kostya and being on Wade's detail with, yes, Cheryl, the inimitable Cheryl, Emmy nominated Cheryl Rowe, Cheryl Lee Rowe, this season. What has it been like for you getting to work with these incredible acting forces, and what really have you taken away from your time together besides Demetra's funny, silly?
Oh my God, I was so spoiled working with those two. So spoiled working with those two this season. Like, I was privileged to be spending time on set and on camera with both of those actors. Easy season three highlight, for sure. A day on set with Demetria is always a good day. She's talented. She's a consummate professional. She's always prepared. She's super sharp. She's efficient. Like, it's just, you couldn't ask for more from a scene partner, and also just like someone getting through the technical aspects of the day. And being on set with her is how I wish every day on set could go. She's also one of the only people on the cast that can make me blush, which she abuses mercilessly. But you know what? Fair enough. If I had that kind of power, I'd probably abuse it too. So there was always lots of laughing on set with Demetria. She could just get me. She gets me even through WhatsApp messages. She'll send me a voice note and like I'll just be beat red. And I'm like, you knew what you were doing, didn't you? Anyways, Cheryl could read the back of a cereal box to me, and I would just stop everything I was doing to listen to that amazing voice.
The cadence of her voice, the boom, like, I'm telling you, I'm under her spell. I don't know if she's a witch in some way, but she, like, you know, she got a power. She's got lots.
You and me both. Some powerful workings there. I had to put some pressure on myself to stay grounded in, like, the first few scenes that I shot with just Cheryl, because, like, she has such gravity, and you're just like, oh, God. Oh God, don't mess it up. Yeah, I've been missing Cheryl's voice, but I've been getting my fix through Abbott Elementary.
Yeah.
If anyone else needs more Cheryl in their life beyond Motherland,
we all
go
do.
Check it out.
I know.
Yes, such a good show.
That just proves her range too, though. Like, she can do these incredible, dramatic, and deeply, you know, intensely rooted, suspenseful shows, and then like boom, there she is, like, sweet Jesus, and the other one, like, you know, the little baby Jesus, and the other one, too. Like in a snap, like, you can, like, that's just, like, a really big attribute to her talents and range.
Yeah, she's a pro. There's no other word for it. Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about the social aspect of things, in the sense of, like, going through Twitter and going through Instagram and seeing these comments. And you recently got to attend a convention, participate in QFX, and kind of get a real, like, actual person-to-person, you know, interaction and feedback and just fandemonium, I'll call it.
Fandemonium!
I like to call the switches, I know they're called switches, but I call them fan molly with an N, because yes, they sort of blur that lovingly way. And I wanted to ask, what kind of has it meant to you then, and learning more and seeing these messages and receiving this kind of feedback from fandom spaces and having your character shipped, or having, you know, just someone seeing themselves reflected in this character or in their expressionism either as well.
Oh my gosh. QFX was such a cool experience. It was my first convention ever, like, as an attendee or, how do I say this? Like a panelist, I guess. My brain wanted to say attendee, attender, but that is the same panelist thing.
Right. I got you.
Honestly, the QFX convention was more of an aha moment for me than any of the fandom on social media had been up until that point. And I've had some genuinely meaningful conversations and connections through different platforms online, but to meet and laugh with and speak with and hug the people for whom this show and or the character of M are so important was an overwhelming and emotional and humbling experience. And also getting to do that, like, alongside my co-stars was just so cool to do that, like, outside of the set, the sets that we were all working on together. Social media allows for beautiful moments of connection, but it will never match real life. And this was a novel experience for me. That being said, that the fans of the show and of M have really turned up the volume this season. I think I feel the love on TikTok and Instagram. My comments are exploding. It feels different than last season. It's really cool. And I think that's partly to do with maybe us finally getting to see a bit more angles of this character to be behind the curtain a bit, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to attend, but I know my good friend Alicia was, like, the sort of the fandom what do you call it, like, representative, thank you. Yes. Who really treated everyone, amongst all the other, of course, incredible people who were the the people who were the moderators, that's the word I'm looking for, moderators, the wonderful moderators of the panels. I again continue to learn a lot. I got to watch your panel with Ames, who was the moderator, and just watching all of you together as a group through the combined panels was just a wonderful treat all around. And I worked with Alicia about the ice cream truck, and I wanted personally to say thank you for getting in and going in and enjoying an ice cream. I know that's a treat for you in turn, but to say
thank you. Are you kidding? That was amazing. Oh my God. Arlen and I were so excited.
That was a nice collaboration from us and our friends at the Asian Spree Cell, who I know you're quite familiar with. So
you all blew me away with that organizational hat trick. I was just like, you did what now? There's a what, Chuck? Run. Yes. It wasn't donuts, but ice cream's a top contender.
I was going to say, I understand it wasn't the full love language that you're used to, but it wasn't a love language as well.
I've made no secret of my love for donuts, but ice cream will always have a place in my heart. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. It's just again continues to say just how much the fans really appreciate you, the conversations that you share through your IG posts, or even seeing just watching your stories about training, stretching, what your Maui the pocketbook, like those
Yes.
moments are just as much something that we get to enjoy in these great glimpses that you shared, and how much you share of is very generous. So thank you for those moments that we get to watch through your Instagram.
That's so sweet. I mean, Maui brings a lot of people a lot of joy. I think it would be illegal to not share his cuteness with everyone. And it's been a weird thing, you know? I think I said before, like I started off as a stunt performer, and people don't know stunt performers' names, and if you see the stunt performer's face on screen, something probably went wrong because you're supposed to believe it's the actor, you know, like it's a stunt double,
Correct.
sorry,
Right.
right? So, you know, the increase in audience that being on a show like Motherland has brought to my digital spaces is overwhelming at times, I'll say. And I'm glad to hear if the silly things I share from my day make people happy. I think it's possibly futile, but happening anyways, effort on my part to like offer context to my life so that it's not just like a parasocial fever dream, you know?
I
Yeah.
mean, you never know the type of day somebody is having, and getting to watch you pet the cat the other day was super cute.
Oh my God, I was so happy about that. Yes.
Getting to kind of feel the frustration of you having to carry your luggage down all those steps at every single airport, anywhere you went,
It's like
was there.
such a classic Montreal experience. Like the Montreal Metro is fantastic, but it's very deep in some stations. So if the escalators are out, which they probably are, yeah, you're lugging. I had every piece of circus rigging to my name in that suitcase. It was a heavy suitcase. It was overweight. I got my workout in that day, lugging it up and down 5 flights of stairs because the escalator was broken and there's no elevator. Terrible accessibility score, but that's a conversation for another day.
Yes, but it is nice to have that moment, like, because like I said, you never know what kind of day someone is having, so getting to share something like cute where you're chilling with Maui, or even something like when you're sharing what you do go through for your training that can be really interesting, it can really have an effect on someone else as well. So thank you for things that you might think are just silly that make a big difference at the same time to others who do watch.
Oh, thank you so much.
Kind of going back a step, from the original breakdown of M, and what has really kind of stood out to you the most about this evolution and the power of your character now that we get to see them from season two through season three?
M comes in to their own in the role Anacostia places them in, with Wade's service, certainly. M is inherently, inseparably tied to the military, of course, because all witches are in this universe. But I think there's something to be said about the freedom that M might feel in shadowing Wade as opposed to being an active coven leader. And being in the environments that such a position would generate instead of constantly being on base at Fort Salem. Military spaces, like we've touched on a couple times already today, are heavily gendered. And while, let's say, survivable, while still always being a kind of home, I think that a lot of trans and non-binary fans of the show recognize the value and meaning of having spaces to work in or live in away from the spaces that remind us of old versions of ourselves or ask us to be versions of ourselves that don't feel authentic or good, that ask us to fit inside structures that are uncomfortable. It can be life-changing to finally find yourself in an environment where it's not structured or governed by the things that used to be creating the borders on your life. If that makes sense. Like, we all find a way to make it work when we're in a space that we're not very comfortable in, but I don't think it's a coincidence that it's when M is finally away from the extremely gendered environment that we meet them in season two, that they really begin to come into their own now in season three. The thing that stands out the most to me of M from original breakdown to the last page of season three is their resilience. There's so much unspoken when it comes to this character. Like, M would have had to navigate conscription at 18 based on a gender binary that made no room for who they were. They would have to decide which of two ill-fitting options was the one they had the best chance of tolerating and surviving, like picking between building weapons with men or basic training with the women, and then they had to continue to serve in a world that at every turn reinforced the notion that the very essence of who they are is something that doesn't fit or belong, even while demanding potentially like the ultimate sacrifice from them if it came down to it. It's the military. There's pain and heartbreak and defeat lurking at every corner behind M's cavalier attitude and smirking and ass kicking. It's not nihilism, and it's not disobedience, and it's not a lack of care. I think that when we can find moments of levity in the midst of existences or pockets of time in our lives that we feel trapped in or trapped by, then that's where we see like a really true and hard won strength. And that's part of what's so powerful about M. That's what stands out to me about them.
Well, before I ask the next question, I know we've been talking for quite a while. I just want to check in with you personally to see if you're okay to continue. Do you have more time? Are you feeling all right?
Thank you for the check-in. Yes, I just need to turn off something in my kitchen very quickly, and then we can resume. Is that all right?
Certainly.
Okay, give me 60 seconds.
Go for it.
Okay. Okay, rock and roll, lock and load, let's go.
I just wanted to make sure that, you know, you felt comfortable, you're feeling up to it, and I do have obviously a few more questions, but if you prefer to stop, please don't, you know, feel obligated that we can keep going.
I really appreciate that. We're good though, let's keep going.
Okay. So we talk about M being in a different space this season, season three, but also, we get to see Evan some civvies too, and that yeah. suit was pretty overwhelming with the fandom.
Yes, the internet loved the suit. Just you wait, folks. Just you wait.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously in War College, we got to see M in uniform, and I wanted to talk a little bit about how does M, the M we see here in these civilian clothes. Kind of extend into their form of further expressionism as well. And mm-hmm. you talked a little bit about this a little, you know, in the last question as well.
Yeah, I'd say maybe it's not about so much about an expression of identity in terms mm-hmm. of M's civvies, and more about an expression of practicality, because they yeah. need to be able to move through all those air vents with ease, obviously. I love this subject. Like, M's War College uniform, I've mentioned this, oh gosh, I guess last year when I was doing some interviews for season two, but it was a combination of the men's and women's jackets. And that is a nod to M's non-binary identity on the part of Tracy Bolton, who's the show's costume designer. Tracy took a lot of care and attention to detail when it came to making that jacket for M. And when another non-binary actor was hired on the show for a small role this season that's airing, they were able to wear a uniform that matched them too, which I thought was really beautiful. They also, we were talking about circus training, they had to remake my wardrobe between season two and season three because I couldn't even fit the old jacket over my arms from all the circus training I did between seasons. Whoops! Sorry.
Good for you.
I know. I was like, oh, this feels like a bad, this feels unprofessional, but I'm also really pleased with myself.
Yeah. As you rightfully should, yeah.
when it came to street clothes, like moving away from the uniform, we lose some of the subtle signifiers that the non-binary jacket Tracy designed offered to like eagle-eyed fans. I did have some people write me about the jacket. They're like, Is it on purpose? And I'm like, yes, it is. So, I mean, clothes don't have a gender. Fashion has no gender, but a short walk into any clothing store will promptly try to convince you to the contrary. And it's been, I know I'm a little bit off topic here, but it's relevant enough. It's been interesting to observe from a safe distance on Twitter, as in lurking, but not engaging. it's been interesting to observe how people react differently to M in street clothes in online discussions, because I mean, there's no other way to say it. More people interpret the character of M as being a man this season when it comes to the scenes that they're in street clothes. Whereas last season, in season two, because there was an absence of any overt discussion of M's identity, I would say that strangers who didn't, you know, like keep up with the show's pre-season two announcement that a non-binary character was being added, most of those people assumed I was a girl instead of a boy. So something is happening for people like based on the civilian clothing choices that are happening. And I think that it's an interesting reflection of just like a broader conversation I've been having this week a lot about being non-binary, because it was Non-Binary Awareness Week. Yesterday, Thursday, was International Non-Binary People's Day.
Yes.
So, I mean, being non-binary is about your insides, and every non-binary person will dress up their outsides differently. Consequently, every person who sees a non-binary person will interpret that dressing up differently based on their own biases, whether they've had any exposure to trans or gender non-conforming people, stuff like that. So I'd actually say M's civilian clothes have been more of a litmus test than anything else for people trying to figure out if I'm a guy or a girl this season than anything else. It's been interesting. It's disappointing to people either way when they find out. They're like, oh. But I'm just sitting here like that gif of, you know, Elmo with the flames behind him is kind of what I feel like. Yeah. I'm good. I'm fine with it. I'm just watching the world burn.
The very essence of it.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was kind of like the day the internet broke on Tuesday.
Well, it's like those moments, I should talk about this a bit more. Those moments of confusion that people have when they see someone like me or M, because I mean, I'm M, right? Sorry. Yeah. Oh, my brain fog is setting in. Sorry. Okay. Moments of confusion have one of two resolutions. One of them is very ugly. And that is when people respond with violence or hatred, which is something I am not unfamiliar with, nor I think are many other trans and non-binary people. But the lovely side that can sometimes come out of confusion is that little moment of like, wait, what? Can be just enough to lift whatever operating system was running in the background of someone's mind about what a woman has to look like, or a man has to look like, or what non-binary people are, or if they even exist, or like any of the funny things people tell themselves. That confusion can just like create a little bubble of like, wait, what? That's extended enough for them to start thinking about the world in a different way. And, you know, you could do it the long way around. The long way around is like a lengthy conversation that may or may not involve queer theory or examples of other non-binary characters in pop culture, and it just depends if you have the time to do it. But confusion can kind of fast track that for some people. So as much as confusion can create some very unpleasant reactions from people. There is the brighter side of it, where people kind of laugh at themselves and share that it helped them kind of think about something differently, which I think is pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, off screen, we talked a little bit about this relationship that we get, that we're privileged to from the outside see, but that you have with the most beautiful soul, Arlen, who we adore.
Yes.
And, you know, we sort of see a little bit of glimpses through other cast members that we got to see, like from a little bit behind the scenes before the show, the season, pardon me, started to air. I think there were a couple of teases here and there of photos. How has being part of the series and kind of in turn fostering these special interpersonal relationships, like the ones that we get to watch through your stories, I guess, in a sense,
right.
kind of how they left this significant imprint on you, becoming, bonding and becoming this kind of beautiful friendship that we've seen kind of blossom, especially I'd say you and Arlen, because we see you and Arlen the most, but
sure. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I'll speak to that a little bit. Whenever I get a question like this in a conversation, I always feel like I have to just mention this briefly, which is that, I know, like, for me, before I started working as an actor, I was always very curious about, like, interpersonal dynamics between cast members on set. Like, are they friends? Do they hate each other? Do they talk? Is it just work? Are they best buds? And, you know, working as a stunt performer, your job is kind of just to not bother the actors. Like, you're supposed to just not exist until it's time to fall down. And then as soon as you're done falling down, you make yourself scarce so that you don't bother anyone. And, when it came to the Motherland cast, like, it's genuinely such a good vibe on set, but we were still filming through a continuously evolving pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I wonder, I'll never know what would have been, could have been different in terms of like building relationships with more of my castmates if we hadn't been filming in a pandemic. Because, you know, it honestly wasn't really possible to socialize or engage with many of my castmates as freely as I would have otherwise liked, because the continuation of the show depended on us all being responsible and cognizant that if you increased your risk of exposure on a possible positive test, it would throw a massive wrench in the works for the production. It would affect dozens of people's daily lives. Like, the pressure to not test positive was so massive that I think all of us lived fairly isolated kind of pockets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of moments of connection that I had sometimes came through something as mundane as shuttling to endless COVID tests together. And that's honestly where I spent probably the most time and had lovely conversations with, as a result, the lovely Kylie Brown, who you and I were discussing just before we started the interview. And as you said, yes, working in the film and television industry means that you meet people you'd otherwise probably never cross paths with. That's certainly true of Arlen, as I've mentioned before, and that's been a friendship that has continued beyond the world of Motherland. It's also true of Demetria McKinney, who I really value having in my life and who I love cheering on from afar. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about what Demetria is working on right now, but if you Google her name, maybe the internet will provide. I don't know. She's such a rock star, and I'm just like a little hype boy off in the backwoods of Canada, you know. Well, I will say my maybe one of my favorite season 3 new friend surprises was our Marshall, Michael Horse. Yes, one of the people I've had the most laughs with of anyone I've ever worked with, including Demetria, who makes me blush. Michael cracks terrible puns from the moment he spots you on set until the moment you're gone from his eyesight. And they're delightfully bad. I can't even call them dad jokes. I don't know what to call them. He's a wonderful storyteller, and he's a really talented artist. So every time I was on set, I got to chat with him about his jewelry, or he's a ledger painter, If anybody's listening and they don't know what a ledger painter is, Google it. It's spelled L-E-D-G-E-R, ledger painter, or him and his wife, Penny, who is a very passionate environmental activist, Michael told me. They have a website called gatheringtribes.com where you can look at some of the visual art he's made and his career. Like, he's really accomplished. And also one of the rare people where, like, as soon as I see him on set, I could feel myself relax immediately. I didn't have enough time with Michael. I really hope the stars align so I can work with him again. And I hope people are enjoying his performance as much as I am. Because, like, I got the experience of being on set with him, being the marshal, and now I get to enjoy it again on the other side of the screen, and it's just as good. Yeah, he's delightful. But to wrap up my rambling and make it short and sweet, life is, yes, inarguably better for knowing and having people like Arlen and Dimitri in it. That's the simplest way to put it.
I think people are definitely intrigued and becoming very, very further curious about Michael's character, the great Marshal, and they have a lot of theories. So I love the theories that, like, he's like Rael's grandfather, or he has some sort of connection to Rael's family. And
the pink earrings that we see him wearing, he made those. Like, yeah, he made a lot of the jewelry that he's, like, his character is wearing. It's really cool. They just incorporated it. It's amazing.
I'm hoping that he or his wife will share more photos as well. I think they shared a couple, or one at least, through Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you letting us know the website as well, where people can go and find out more about the work that he does, activism, and then the work that they do with the ledger painting as well.
Yeah, gatheringtribes.com. I'm a Michael Horse fan. You heard it here first, folks.
He's charming, but, like, you talk about the dad jokes or puns that he does, but he's, like, kind of charming in, like, a prickly way as this marshal, because, like, he's yelling at them, like, go to bed, or he tells, like, just laughs and, like, that's a baby's call. My dog's a better
pack leader than you. Oh, all of his lines are so iconic.
Yes. That's the part of, like, the people love him as, like, a curmudgeon in a way, but, like,
honestly, it's cathartic. As M, like, the bellwether unit sassed off to me every second of our existence in season two, and I just had, it's fine, get it out of your system. But Michael Horse, sorry, the marshal, is just like, ha, that's cute, go to bed. And I'm like, yes, tell them.
Well, we see a lot, again, we talk a lot about Instagram and the wonderful content that you provide to us. And we see a lot of your circus work and your training through these glimpses and your talks about various projects, like through your Patreon or through your posts and things like that, and applying for different kinds of grant funding. Yeah. What really engages your creative drive and really kind of fuels your passion, whether it be, you know, your expressionism through your own art or through the work that you're doing on the flip side of the screen?
Oh, what a great question. Thank you. Circus, I'd say my circus work is what grounds me and remains a bit of a through line in the chaotic and often unpredictable nature of TV and film work for me. I know that sounds really funny. Hey, yes, go find a stable job to calm you down. I know. Join the circus. No, I know. I mean, being a contemporary circus artist can happen in many forms. You can find yourself working a 2-year contract for a company like Cirque du Soleil, or a 6-week cabaret contract in Zurich, Switzerland, or a one-off corporate event for some fabulous gala somewhere. Like, there's so many ways to do it. And I know most people picture, like, the traveling tent when they still hear circus, but Canada has a fabulous reputation in terms of its contemporary circus artists internationally. And as such, we have robust support from some of our arts funding bodies, like the Canada Council for the Arts. And yes, I'm currently working on a grant that I was awarded by the Canada Council for the Arts, stretching out over 2-year time span. And it's inspired by this gender-bending historical acrobat that performed under the name of Barbette, who was a really big deal in Paris and Europe in the 1920s and 30s.
Wow.
And what I like to do with circus, it becomes a way for me to express and question and investigate subjects that maybe in the world of the work I do on film and television get an occasional nod, but aren't explored in detail. So it gives me a bit of, gives me the illusion of having some agency and control in my life. I don't know if that's true or not. I've been hard at work since Smotherland Wrapped, researching and starting creation on an aerial straps act that deals with a lot of the artistic themes that I continue to be interested in and that my previous works have kind of mucked around in. So I'm interested, obviously, in questions around gender and transness, in what we find beautiful, in what we find grotesque, in memory, in the relationship between risk and spectacle, which is a particularly sticky one when it comes to circus, just any kind of liminal space. And then, yes, I maintain a writing practice in tandem with that physical creation practice. It grounds the work for me. I get a record or documentation of the work that is often ephemeral and fleeting when it comes to a performance art form like circus or dance. And yeah, I guess this is the point. This is my shameless Patreon plug. If you want to read my stuff, patreon.com/strangewonderfulcreature. And more importantly, I keep my Patreon set up so that it doesn't charge you until the end of the month. There's really no better platform or medium for me to house my writing online right now. I don't want it to be in an open blog because I've tried that before and it's just a bit overwhelming. So having it behind a sign-up wall makes the most sense. But if a subscription service isn't your jam, but you want to read some of my long-form ramblings on gender or circus and stuff like that, just know that you can sign up and just set a reminder in your calendar to unsign up before the end of the month, and it won't charge you any money. Unfortunately, Patreon doesn't let you give freebie codes yet, but the platform might change in the future, so we'll see what happens. Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's long gaps in contracts when it comes to working as an actor or in my previous life as a stunt performer, and doing this kind of work as an artist that is using circus as a medium of expression, it just gives me a bit of consistency in my life. I received a very late in life autism diagnosis, although for anybody who knows me, it's not surprising in any way. And working in film and television is extremely challenging in many regards when it comes to the things about autism that sometimes make my life less pleasant. And circus is something that is both like a regulating activity for me. So like I like spinning because it makes me calm down and it turns down all the noise in my head. It's kind of, I guess, it's a stim, just really fast spinning. And I don't get that in film. Like I really struggle with schedule changes and disruptions to my routine, and circus is the way that I've tried to kind of overlay some routines in my life, something that I can count on. So, I mean, in Vancouver, when we were filming Motherland Fort Salem, I was hanging out in CrossFit gyms, scaring the athletes, or going to a wonderful circus space there called the Underground Circus. If anybody's in the West Coast, check it out. And I do the same thing whether I'm in Toronto or in Montreal. I just finished filming on a little horror movie, which I'm not allowed to talk about yet. A little guy that'll be out at the end of the year. And it was amazing to be in Montreal working on a film project because it's a fool's ransom of circus spaces in Montreal. Montreal is one of like the circus meccas of the world, so I'm pretty spoiled for choice when work takes me there. But I've fully taken us in several tangents, but it's both a necessary thing to keep me grounded, as well as something that lets me feel like I'm living my life to the fullest.
I didn't know you're busy. Are you still selling your books through your Patreon or?
Actually only got about 30 of those books left. So if you have no idea what we are talking about, I put out a beautiful coffee table book called Slow Circus about the last project that I completed through grant funding from the Canada Council for the Arts. So if you see any of the silly stuff that I post on TikTok or Instagram, you probably see me working on an aerial apparatus called aerial straps. But the previous bulk of my circus work was as a professional contortionist. And one of the acts that I made was in a very specially modified vacuum tower. I will refrain from describing the environments that such devices are usually found in. And if you are underage, please don't Google it. Otherwise, you can infer what I'm probably talking about. It's like a PVC cube or a rectangle, a prism, with a latex envelope over it. And it's actually a two-person act. So there's someone that I trust very, very deeply sitting behind the tower, operating vacuums and venting air into the space so that this device can essentially kind of like close tight on me and freeze me in position like a bug in amber, and then slowly breathe open again. And it makes it hard to see me and then easy to see me. And it was an act that I used to kind of play with how apparatus can change an audience perception of a performer's gender. And especially when it comes to the discipline of contortion is very heavily gendered. If you are a male contortionist or your body is interpreted to be that of a man's, your work is by and large interpreted by an audience member as something that's grotesque or something that is comedic, with very, very little wiggle room outside of those two monoliths. And then if your body is interpreted as being that of a woman's or you're very feminine presenting, it's almost always fetishized or sexualized. And so with that piece, I was really curious about what would happen if I was working in the context of an apparatus like the vacuum tower, where the apparatus itself kind of obscured my body to such an extent that an audience member can't easily tell if it's a man or a woman that they're watching perform. And I wrote a bunch of essays about my creation process and the reception of this piece in that book. And I don't think I'm going to be opening that store to sell the last 30 copies until a little bit later this year, because part of the grant I'm currently working on between film and TV projects, the Barbette Aerial Straps grant that we touched on a moment ago, I'm making a new act for it, but I'm also compiling all of the writings that are being housed on Patreon and polishing them and building on them to put them in a next edition of Slow Circus. So it'll be Slow Circus Barbette that eventually comes out, probably sometime early next year. And at that point, I'll have to revisit whether or not I can do a reprint of Vacuum or not. But for the time being, if that sounds really cool, you'll just have to sit on your hands until you see me drop a hint about it in my Instagram story. But right now, there isn't really a way to get your hands on a copy. If you already have one, good job.
Yes, I don't have one, but I want to personally make sure that we do mention that you did have a book available to also purchase, that people who are interested, if and when they are available, can
thank
go
you so much
and get a
yes
copy.
it was a victim of its own success. I printed about 400 of them and we're down to 30. I was like, oh, well, I thought that would take about 5 more years. Whoops. Okay. Yeah, it'll be available one day. I just don't know when yet. And I'm heading into another film project, actually, imminently in the next few days. So part of the challenges of being a working actor means that I'm traveling a lot for work. I will be away from home for this next project, and it makes shipping a heavy hardcover coffee table book very challenging from the road. I don't even try to do it. It's also why it's a little hard to get your hands on a copy, because I don't have someone who does that for me. It is a one person circus show. I am the dog, the pony, and the acrobat, and the shipping minion.
Yeah. I can see it now.
Yes, the glamorous life of an actor.
Well, just to kind of combine my last two questions together, are there any episodes that you're kind of most looking forward to fans seeing, or is there anything that we really didn't kind of touch upon that you want to make sure that we also make mention and include as well?
I don't think there's anything else that we haven't touched on that we should. I'm very, very flattered you let me indulge in waxing rhapsodic about my circus things and writing. The episode I'm most looking forward to fans seeing, or that I'm most proud of filming, I'm very proud of episode 4. I'm so happy that people are responding so positively to it. But just to add an element of suspense, I will say that I'm very much looking forward to, I think it's episode 9, purely on the suits front. That's it. I'm zipping my lips after that point. That's all I have to say.
That is a very good tease. That is a very appreciative
Oh,
tease. Well, those are all of my questions. As I speaking of indulging, I wanted to say thank you for indulging me, because these are a lot of questions. This is a lot of your time. I know how busy you are. I appreciate you taking this extensive time and getting to chat with me and sharing all these wonderful, I guess, like family moments with me, I would call them.
family.